Can you please put your hand up if you have experienced a limiter, and leave your hand up if you experience them regularly? Okay, I can put my hands up. Do you mean everybody? No, don't say to everybody, because sometimes when people admit their experiences in public, there is a lot of pride and ego and comparison. You put a hand up and say, "Her, no way." And you put and say, "No, that really sucks. You mean my wife is getting all these limiters and I don't?" So that's why we don't actually just tell other people. There was a Korean nun once gave this wonderful advice: if you ever do get enlightened, don't tell anybody. Because if you do, you have to spend the rest of your life proving it to your friends. So you keep this with very deeply personal experiences. Tell your teacher if you wish, but don't go around, you know, with a nice little slogan on your t-shirt: "I am enlightened." So that's actually why we don't let people know. Can you explain the dangers of rebirth in the lower heavenly realms? Do they keep 5 precepts up there? Did you read the Pope just said recently that dogs can go to heaven? He did actually say that because some kid had died. No, that Pope Francis. Some dog had died, and the kid asked him, "Well, you know, my dog's died. Did he go to heaven?" And the Pope actually said yes. But he didn't really know what he was actually saying, because if dogs go to heaven, now you've got some equity, so you have to have cats go to heaven as well. Now, it's like equity. We can't have any discrimination anymore. Just like, you know, that Australian government agency in Canberra, they advertised for a secretary, but they had to say Equal Opportunity Commission was advertising for a secretary. So an equal opportunity, you cannot discriminate on age, on gender, sexual orientation, you know, and race or religion or anything. No discrimination at all, because equal opportunity. So they didn't know what to do when a dog applied for the job. They can't discriminate just because you're a dog. So they said, "Well, can you do the job?" And the dog said, "Woof." So they said, "Okay, get on the computer and write a letter, you know, give your resume, let's see your type." And you wouldn't believe this dog. He jumped up on the chair, you know, turned on the computer, got on the mouse, and he just moved the mouse around and patted it every now and again, and he wrote this perfect letter. Incredible the dog could do that. So they passed the first test and said, "Okay, can you do a spreadsheet?" So they got on Excel, a perfect spreadsheet. This dog was a genius. They said, "Okay, you know, because, you know, this is Canberra and there's lots of people in here, you have to speak a second language." And so the dog went, "Meow." Another silly joke, but nice for the evening. So, the Pope said dogs can go there, so if dogs can go there, you must allow cats as well. If cats can go there, you must allow mice. Imagine heaven with dogs barking all night, cats just meowing at midnight. Gee, that's not the heaven I'd like to go to. I think the Pope made a big mistake up there. You know, in some monasteries in Thailand, you know, they dump them, their dogs. And they go barking all night. You can't meditate in some of those monasteries in Bangkok because they dump their unwanted dogs there. They don't have dog havens. They know the dogs will not get killed and they'll be looked after in the monasteries. And those monasteries can get really, really noisy. So, you know, that's why in heaven, cool, it must be really noisy with all those dogs up there by now. Anyway, the danger of rebirth in lower heavenly realms. Do they keep 5 precepts up there? What about the higher heavenly realms of formlessness, i.e. eternal bliss? Do you still recommend human rebirth above all the rebirths and enlightenment? Okay, this is the cosmology of Buddhism. Not just one realm, but many, many realms. Just like the ghost realm. Ghosts. How many of you have seen ghosts? In Jhana Grove. In the middle of the night. Are you the one who lives in the haunted cottage? I mean, oh, I tell Bob, stop it. I'm not going to go to sleep tonight. Now, don't worry, you're perfectly safe in this place because ghosts aren't allowed. In this place. And I actually mean that because sometimes these beings, you know, they know that human beings are much more powerful, especially monks, and they just can't get in here, you know, when there's good monks around. So you are perfectly safe. But one of the best ghost stories which I heard recently, and I think tell you a nice ghost story, real ones, because I was doing a funeral over in, it was Karakata Cemetery. That's one of the big cemeteries here in Perth for a Chinese person who died. There's a burial. And the Chinese funeral site is right at the other end of the cemeteries. And there's a bit of discrimination. All the Christian ones are really close by. But, you know, it's right at the other end. So it's a long walk to get there. And I knew I'd been there many times. I knew it was a long walk. And if you go to these funerals in Australia, you know, they have the priest and the funeral director. We walk ahead. Then you got the hearse with a coffin in. Then you got all the mourners behind. So I knew it was a long walk, you know, and getting a bit bored. So you say hello to the, you know, funeral director. And, you know, she was this elderly woman. So I managed to ask her, you know, how long have you been working in this job? She said, oh, about 30, 40 years. And I'm going to retire soon. I said, oh, great. You must have got some great ghost stories. It's a great opportunity to get some more material for my talks. And then she said, oh, yeah, you know, see them all the time. She really was honest with me. So in the funeral parlours, you know, they're working in the office, and they see the person walk past, and there it's the person supposed to be in the box, you know, because they're ghosts, and they just hang out in the funeral parlours. And they just get used to them. So what's the scariest one you know of? And she told, well, the scariest one just happened a few weeks earlier. She said that in that funeral industry, you know, in that hearse, you know, you may have gone to funerals, you've probably all gone to funerals, the hearse, the box they put the coffin in, that is cleaned after every funeral, inside and out. You know, even though maybe three or four funerals a day, after each funeral, it's always cleaned. So this guy, they employ someone to clean the hearse after every funeral. That's his only job, cleaning the hearse. And so he just finished cleaning the inside of the hearse at this funeral parlour. No, totally nice, locked the doors. And then, as he was cleaning the outside of the hearse, all the windows inside steamed up. A mist appeared on the windows. Why, he doesn't know. And then, handprints appeared on the misty windows, all over. Something inside was trying to get out. That's a nice ghost story, that. But, you know, they're so used to the ghosts, they don't harm you. They just open the door, peer in the windows and stop, throw the ghost. If you want to get out, just knock. So, you know, there are ghosts and there are, you know, devas, angels. One of the best angel, heavenly being stories, I did write about it, I think it was in the Goodbye for Most book, about the monk. This is an incredible story because I know the people involved. Checked it out many times. This is 100% accurate. There was a monk. Actually, he was not a monk yet. He became a monk. I knew him. He went over to America a few years ago. I don't know where he's ended up now. But he started off as, before he was a monk, as doing, was it Peace Corps work in Thailand. So he volunteered to the Peace Corps work. This must be in the 80s, I think, early 80s. Or mid-80s. Do Peace Corps work. And after doing his couple of years of Peace Corps work, you know, he was in Thailand, he got to know the culture and was interested in the religion, and he wanted to give it a try because in Buddhism you can become a monk for just a short period of time, just temporary ordination. So he thought, you know, I'd like to try this out, you know, an experience before he went home. But he didn't know how to do it. And he was staying in a hotel just on the edge of Bangkok. And so he thought he'd ask the concierge, now, how do you become a monk? Now, the concierge in hotels in Bangkok, they know many things, but not how to become a monk. Yeah. So he gave him some information, but it wasn't really accurate. He said there is a monastery in the centre of Bangkok. It's called Wat Bawon. And he said there's often this Western monks in that monastery. So that's a place you should go and ask. And what you should do is to get some food and go there early in the morning so that you can put some food in the monk's bowls when they come on alms round. And after putting some food in the monk's bowl, ask the monk, I want to be a monk myself, please help. And that was the advice. It's not the correct advice, but you know, that's what he was said. And it was also, he didn't know what early in the morning was. They went there about 4 o'clock in the morning. And the temple was all locked up. No one was there. And he was walking up and down outside the temple, not knowing what to do, when he was approached by a Thai man who asked him, what are you doing? He said, well, you know, this is the advice I was given. I want to become a monk and it's all locked up. And the man said, of course it's locked up. It's too early. They don't come out for another hour and a half, 2 hours. But this Thai man, who spoke perfect English, said, well, look, you know, I've got the keys to the gate. I'll let you inside, show you around until the monks come out. So he opened up the big iron gate and took him inside to the main meditation hall, the ordination hall, the Holy of Holies in Wat Bawon. And he opened the door of the main hall, turned on the lights, and in these old Thai temples they have all these murals, these paintings on the walls inside. And all those paintings, they tell a story, but you've got to actually trace the history. It's one painting, just like a cartoon, but it hasn't got these frames. You've got to start somewhere and you can trace the whole story around if you know what it is. So, you know, even sometimes I look at those paintings and you have to work out, you know, just which way around the story goes. And, you know, mostly Jataka tales. And so he spent an hour and a half just explaining to this American guy all the amazing meaning of these murals. And it was just a mine of information, this Thai guy, and because he told him everything and also just the history of the painting, because it was usually offered as a donation because a child died in childbirth or your mother passed away through some disease or something, and they did this as merit making and passed that on to their deceased relations. And the American guy said it was really interesting, and the hour and a half went by really quickly, and then the Thai guide, the guide, said, oh, just go outside now, I'll lock up because the monks are coming out in any minute now. And that's what he did, and he saw this old Thai monk put some food in the bowl and asked him to become a monk. He said, wait here, when I come back I'll take you inside, which he did. And so he started the process of learning all the chanting and how to put on your robes and everything else to become a monk. But one day this American, still in training, complained. He said, look, now the monk you've got to try and explain these things to me, I can't understand his English, it's hopeless. And the Thai, because he could speak a little bit of Thai, he said, well, this is the best English speaker we've got in the whole monastery. And that's when this guy, the American, said, I was going to tell you his name, I shouldn't really tell you his name because this guy's still alive. He said, what about that temple boy, you know, who took me in on the first morning I came here, who opened the gate and took me inside the main hall? And at that, the man said, what temple man? Now, the guy who could speak perfect English. There is no such temple boy who speaks English. And there is no one who's got that key. Because that is called, I know that temple, it's called the Royal Gate. Only members of the royal family are allowed to go through that gate. And only the abbot and maybe the secretary has got the keys to that gate. Same in the main hall. And you can't turn on the electricity of the place they said they did. So straight away they took him to the abbot, who only recently passed away. And the abbot listened and stopped him halfway and got the secretary to come and write this all down. Because, as I just said, no one knew who this Thai guy was who could speak perfect English. And there was no one who had that key. No one was allowed through that gate except for royalty. And no one had the key to the main hall. You can't turn the electricity there. And not even the abbot, the oldest monk in the monastery, knew the stories behind all of those paintings. It was about 150, 180 years previously. And so he wrote it all down because this was really weird. And then they asked him at the end, can you please describe what this man looked like? And this American said, you all look the same. That's what it's like if you're in a foreign country. I go into sort of Thailand and the Thais say, we Westerners, we all look the same. But he said, no, give me some detail. He said, well, he was actually wearing old clothes, you know, the old traditional Thai clothes, not modern clothes. Well, that's something. But what do you look like? Give me a description. You know, when you see somebody and you try and describe it, it's so hard to describe. And he was trying his best to recall, you know, the person. And so he was actually scratching his head and just looking around as you do, and then he stopped. He saw the portrait of the guy on the wall. He said, it was him, that guy there. He was the fellow who opened the gate for me. And that was, everyone really gasped, because that was a portrait of one of the main donors of that temple, King Rama V, who died a long time ago, one of the former kings of Thailand. He didn't know who that photo was, but this king died years and years ago, opened that gate because he was allowed to. He was royal family, and showed this Westerner into the temple. He knew all this information because King Rama V was one of the sponsors of that temple. He built it. He knew everything about it. And this was a heavenly being who came down to help a young American become a monk. That's an absolutely true story. It's in the history of that temple. I know the American involved is still a monk. True story. Ooh. So there are these heavenly beings around. You know, there's no other explanation. This guy's not a crazy fellow at all. So there are these heavenly realms at all. He used to recommend human rebirth above all rebirths. But sometimes with you traditional Buddhists, people keep saying, you go over to a heaven realm, you can't get enlightened. That's absolutely against what the sutras say. Now you read some of those sutras and say when the Buddha was giving a talk, many heavenly beings came down to listen at the same time. And they got enlightened. So even in the heavenly realms you can still get enlightened. So, you know, wherever you go is fine. Human realm is good. But please don't go to the animal realms. I keep on repeating, there was a guy here, this is a warning to you. There was a fellow here years ago, fortunately I talked him out of this. I asked him, you know, he believed in reincarnation. What are you going to be when you get reincarnated? What do you want to be? He said, I want to be a dog in my next life. I said, a what? A dog. I said, why on earth do you want to be a dog? And he said, well, think about it, Ajahn Brahm. Be logical. A dog doesn't have to go to work on a Monday morning. And a dog doesn't have to do any work at all. You just lay around all day. You get patted. That's the only job you have to do, to make sure you get patted. And give those people something to pat and wag your tail, just to make your family happy. And they feed you the best food, you get free medical care, a bit of exercise in the morning. If you don't want to, you know, they won't take you. And what a beautiful life that is, because, you know, I'm fed up with going to work on a Monday morning and working my butt off. I just want to sleep around all day, just play, like a dog. Because dogs in Australia, and many Western countries, they get looked after really well. Free medical care, great food. Some dogs, they won't eat dog food, they eat your food. And they insist on that, and you give it to them. And, you know, he had a point there, but I mentioned to him. I said, because I know this guy. And I said, look, it's true that you don't have to work if you get reborn as a dog. You can sleep all day, and you can play around, no stress. But you know, in your first weeks of life as a dog, you're taken to the vet to get de-sexed. And then he said, I don't want to be a dog then. Because he liked his sex. So think about it before you decide to be a dog. Dear Ajahn, what do you think about music meditation? I don't mean just listen to music. Play music and completely be the music and focus on every single tone you play. Would you rather count it as a distraction or meditation? And isn't there a realm of music and melodies you can have access through meditation? Okay, first of all, it does calm you down. And sometimes if you're living out there in the world, you come home from work and you try to meditate straight away, you fall asleep sometimes. So, you know, you can actually do a little stepping stone, like a halfway house, just a preparation for meditation by listening to some soft music to relax you. Once you're relaxed there, you know, you can't get into jhanas through listening to music. You can get into the present moment, but, you know, the sense of sound is still very strong. And the whole point of the meditation is all the five senses disappearing. So it's okay, you know, to start with some music, but then after a while you have to let the music disappear and fade away. You've got to be careful, though, with listening to music, because sometimes, what is it called? They call it earworm music. You know, once it gets into you, you can't get it out again. You know, some melodies, they get into your head and they keep going round and round and round and round and round without stop. So sometimes that type of music can actually be addictive. And when you want to get rid of it, you can't. So it can be okay at the specific time in meditation when you really want to relax, because, you know, you're really tired and you want to sort of move from the busyness of work, you know, halfway into, you know, the peace of music, and then go deeper to the silence. Because the silence is the best music of all. The music of silence. And if you're playing music, of course, you have to focus. You have to be there. And anything, any activity, when you really start to excel, you know, there's many things which you learn from meditation which help with the excelling, and also what works to excel you can use in your meditation. And one of them, there's a man here, he was a monk over in Thailand when I was a young monk, and he married this Indian dancer. And she was one of the top Indian dancers. He told me that she was on the front covers of glossy magazines. She was really, you know, the top of her field. And when she came to visit and I was chatting to her, I said, "How do you dance at such a high level?" I remember her saying, I train. But when I actually perform, I forget everything I'd ever learnt. And I just let the dance happen. I have to get out of the way. And don't make that. I can't try doing the dance. I just have to let the dance come. And that's how I perform to such a high level. I think, yeah, exactly. That's how we're supposed to meditate. You know, just get out of the way and let the meditation happen. Because if she gets involved and tries to control the dance, she makes too many mistakes. Train. And when she performs, she totally vanishes and the dance just happens. And that's why she performs to such a high level. And if you ask any top musician, a concert pianist, that's what they do too. When they start, if they try and do something and control it, they always stuff up. They just train, but when they're performing, they vanish and just the music takes over. Or artists as well, top artists, they say, they don't know what they're painting. Just the painting does the painting. Just their hand is just going by itself. This is actually where you disappear. And I can see that what you learn from that level of, you know, classical Indian dancing or really sort of top class classical music where you have to disappear. If you can do that in the dance, you'll be able to do that in the meditation. Just let the meditation happen. If you try and get involved, you interrupt it, you disturb it, and it all falls apart. So letting go. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if we are conditioned by you, are you our teacher in our previous life or previous lives? Have you known me before? When you first saw me, did you think, my teacher has arrived? I think, you know, even though I'm teaching this retreat, I've got many other duties to do as well. And one duty I had to do that, next month I'm giving a talk at Google, and they wanted to have a title for the talk. And so I gave them the title, because many people give talks at Google, so you've got to make it a bit quirky to get someone to go there. And so I said, "Google, your search is over. The Google Guru has arrived." This is making a bit of a fun and games to me. So is that what you thought when you first saw me? My guru has arrived. It didn't matter anyway. And anyway, in life, you don't have one teacher. Many people are your teachers. When you go to school, do you only have one history teacher? When you go to university, only one chemistry teacher or one med school teacher? You have many teachers. Because everyone is strong in different areas. That's why don't just get me to be your teacher. Get everyone. Give me a break. Can you explain more of watching the breath itself without the body? I feel the breath through the body, sensations or movements. It's hard to separate breath with the body. Now this is actually a problem, because if you watch the breath on the body, it's hard to let the body go. But because I told you earlier that I had some hay fever and I couldn't really watch the breath at the tip of the nose where I was told to, as wrongly, that I had to learn how just to watch the breath. So you could do the exercise, close your eyes, breathe in and out 3 times. If you've never meditated before in your life, everyone can do that. And how do you know? And normally people don't know where the breath is located. They just know the breath is going in. It's just so simple, uncomplicated, breath going in. You don't care where it's going in. Just breath going in. So with your perception, that's the only perception you have. Breath going in. You don't worry where it's going in. When breath is going out, who cares? It's going out through your left ear hole or through your backside. Don't matter. Because it's going in. That's what you need to worry about. And when that happens, it means, you don't care about the body. A lot of the body vanishes. Years and years ago, just an experiment, I was getting very peaceful, nice breath, beautiful breath. And I thought, I wonder where it is going in. And as soon as I asked, it was actually the tip of the nose. That was for me. I could feel the tip of the nose then. So that's really interesting. Okay, forget about the tip of the nose, just watch the breath. So you let go of that bodily sensation. Instead, just go for the feeling of the breath. And that really helps you let go of the body. So you don't have to worry, don't use the perception of where it's in the body. Just it's going in. It's inness or outness is the only thing you notice. So if I totally let go, how do I zoom in to see the breath clearly? A lot of time it happens naturally. And you do zoom in, and you don't do it. So who does it? Me. I did it for you. Because I suggested that, I brainwashed you. It's hypnosis, that's all it really is. Because you have a lot of influence on people. And because I said zoom in, you'll find you'll do that naturally. It's just the way that our will is conditioned. Remember I mentioned this, many people don't know what the will is. I understand it totally. You understand how we're all conditioned by what we see, what we hear. Just like that old story of the monk. I won't say what country he was in. He started a sort of a new monastery, a temple actually in town. And hardly anyone would come to his sermons. And so, he was not getting enough donations to pay the bills. So he went to see this old monk. And the old monk said, that always happens when you start out. Not many people know you. It takes a while. But, for the first year or two, in order to get more donations from the people who come, try hypnosis. He said, this is what you should do. When people come to the talk, close all the doors and windows, turn up the heating, and deliberately give a boring sermon. In a low monotone, talking about the Abhidhamma and things which people don't really understand. Until everyone starts falling asleep. And just before they fall asleep, get out your watch, backwards and forwards like this. Until they're hypnotized. And once they're hypnotized, you tell them, when you go out, only 50s and 100s in the donation box. No 5s, 10s, 20s or coins. Only 50s and 100s. And everyone must put one in. At least. And the young man, I can't do that. That's fraud.
So it's not. It's encouraging people to make good karma. And so he tried it.
So the next time he gave a boring sermon, turned the heat up, got everyone sleepy, got his watch out when they were about to fall asleep, hypnotized them and told them only 50s and 100s, and you forget this when, you know, the post-hypnotic suggestion, we still put the 50s and 100s in, but you know, won't forget I told you to. And it worked. After the sermon, when they woke up, they went out, they all put 50s in and $100 in the donation box. He cleaned up, made a fortune. And then he thought, I can't do this every week. You know, they'll soon suss me out, you know, I'll be found out. So he waited for a few more weeks until he needed some money to pay the bills. Did the same thing, closed the doors, closed the windows, you know, put the heater up, gave a boring sermon. People about to fall asleep, got out his watch, but this time he dropped the watch. And he said, shit. And it took him such a long time to clean the temple. That's an old joke. It's a good one. So this is what happens when you hypnotize people. Before he gets bad karma back to you. So this is actually just how, because I suggested, you will zoom in. You'll find you'll do that automatically, naturally. It's been conditioned into you. Can you explain the meaning of the five aggregates? Aggregates, as I understand the word correctly, this is understanding the nature of this thing we call body and mind. And the five aggregates is just a Buddhist way of understanding the body, first of all, and then we've got feelings. By feelings, I mean pleasure, pain, with all the different six senses. Beauty, ugliness, nice smell, bad smell, tasty food, you know, bitter food, whatever it is you don't like. You know, the pleasurable and the unpleasant associated with every sensory experience, or in between. That's, you know, the second. And the third one is perception. Just the way we look at something, we only choose what we're going to see in a person. I can see, like, you know, Abby, or I can see girl, I can see, you know, she lives in Melbourne. Or Sydney now? Melbourne, yeah, I've got it right. So, I can see, you know, getting older every day. I can choose all these different perceptions. And I can't have the two at the same time, but, you know, you just choose one. And that is just the way we look at the world. We select only part of what's out there. That's what we perceive. It's partial. It's not the full picture, because we can't perceive everything. And then we have the next aggregate. It's one of the most interesting. It's called sankharas, and it includes your thoughts and emotions, but in particular your will. That's in this sankharas, the choice, the things which drives you and takes you here, takes you there. And the last one, many people call it consciousness, but I've been much more precise. It's consciousnesses, six of them, and all totally different. Those are the aggregates. And that's basically what makes you up. You know, that I just all those five mingle together. Your body, the pleasure, pain, you know, with all the senses, and even like nice food, disgusting food, and with perceptions, and with will, thoughts, and all the different consciousnesses you have. And the reason why the Buddha split them up into those five is because those are the areas where one thinks one exists. I am the body. It's amazing how many people still see that and think like that. Do you really think you're the body? You'll find out when the doctor says you've only got a few months to live. Ah, I'm dying. You're not dying. It's only the body going. For goodness sake. You've done that so many times before. It's only bodies going. Do you really get fed up when your car crashes? Yeah, another one, that's all. The driver doesn't crash, only the car. The body dies, but not the stream of consciousness. Goes on. So what's the big deal? Especially when someone's old. When they're old and they die, you should celebrate. They're going to get a new vehicle. And the old bomb, you know, it's keeping these old bombs on the road. There's a few old bombs here, weren't they? I don't think it's somebody else I'm talking about.
So would you like a new vehicle? A new model? Trade it in.
I'll be careful. I better not go too far there. But
those are the five aggregates. And so the body's not you. Pleasure and pain. How much of you spend most of your life trying to avoid the unpleasant experience and only get pleasant ones? You can't do that. Have you succeeded yet? Only getting pleasure and no pain. Only seeing beauty and no happiness. Only getting delicious food and no undelicious food. It doesn't matter what you get. Some of it you like, some of it you don't like. It doesn't matter, even no matter how hard Bianca tries. Because all this pleasure and pain business, all pleasure is a gap between two unpleasant feelings. And unpleasure, suffering, is a gap between two pleasant moments. This is just the rise and fall of life. And even if you had a heaven where the food was absolutely delicious, one day it would be a little bit less delicious than it was the day before. And that would be suffering for you. So you can't control pleasure and pain. No more than you can control the weather. Warm, cold. You get both. So this is one of the reasons why just seeking out pleasure is a hopeless cause. You can make it more pleasurable, less painful, but you can never achieve perfection there. And then you got perception. It's amazing with perception. You know, for when you fall in love. Oh, he's the most handsome, wonderful person in the whole world. I'm so lucky to have met a guy like that. And a few years later when you get divorced, he's terrible, he's rotten, he's a B-A-S-T-A-D, I don't know why I ever married him. And sometimes you think, it's not the same guy. If you get a recording of just, you know, when you're going out, just before you got married, and get a recording of, you know, when you have your divorce, are you talking about the same guy? He is the same guy, you know. You just got different perceptions, that's all. Because we see what we want to see. And we want not see what we don't want to see. We're in denial. That's what perception is. It's so bent. That's why we keep making mistakes. Because we see, oh, this is the perfect guy. You don't see the full picture. Like that lady who, when she got married, she told me that in Singapore, that her father took her new husband aside, gave him some advice, father-in-law advice to his son-in-law. And the advice was, you know, you probably think my daughter's absolutely perfect, you just married her. And he said, oh, she's so wonderful. She's so beautiful, she's so charming. Even the way she picks her nose is so delightful. He didn't ever say, I added that, but you know what it's like, you know, when you fall in love with someone. Oh, she's fantastic. I'm so lucky to have been married to a girl like that. And thank you for bringing her up in such a beautiful way. You must be an excellent father. Now, going on like that. And then the father said, yeah, that's what it's like, you know, when you fall in love, when you get married. But give, you know, 2-3 years, then you'll start to see the faults and defects in my daughter. Only after 2 or 3 years. But when you start to see her defects, please remember this, son-in-law. If she never had those defects to begin with, she would have married someone much better than you. Well, that's very true. So when you see the defects in your husband or your partner, remember, you're still lucky because you've got them too. Anyway, can the light of nimitta appear even when the five senses do not disappear? Yeah, it can. Depends how strong the mind is. If you look at the five senses and the sixth sense of mind, mostly because you do so much, your mental, your mind state is just so low in energy. If it's really low in energy, it's called depression. It's so low in energy, your five senses take all the energy. But in meditation, or staying in a place like this, your five senses get subdued, your mind starts to get some energy, and it's like amplitude starts to get just about the same amplitude as the five senses. That's when it can start up here. So your five senses haven't totally disappeared yet. The mind's got some energy, so that's when you can study the nimittas. But you know, it's only when the five senses totally disappear, and that's when the nimitta gets all the energy, and that's when you can really see it. But you can see it while the five senses are still happening.
especially if you've got a very good, powerful, pure mind. The Ajahn, so to get good meditation, we need to stop thinking and then bypass brain to get into the mind. How come brain overpower mind? Is mind more powerful than brain? Of course it is, but we just haven't trained the mind to be more powerful than the brain. And because, you know, we've just basically been a bit lazy, just let the brain do all the stuff. And we trained our brain, you know, the IQ instead of the EQ, the emotional intelligence. And because of that, you know, the brain gets all the attention. And sometimes that, you know, the mind is far stronger than the brain. When people walk over broken glass or fire or sitting on nails, do they use meditation for that? I think they use stupidity for that. Walking over broken glass, fire, sitting on nails. Look, you can always walk around it. You don't need to or wear shoes. This is actually a saying of the Buddha, because now in the Buddha's time, he was traveling with some monks, and there was a monk, or like a hermit, and he said he'd been meditating for years and years and years and years and years and years, and now he could actually walk on water. He could actually walk over the Ganges. And the Buddha turned around to his monk and said, "What a waste of time! Just for a couple of pennies, you can get a boat." What's the point of being able to walk over the Ganges? Yeah, impress other people, start a religion or something. But, you know, what's the point of that when, you know, instead of years and years and years just to walk on water, when you can get a boat, you know, just for a couple of cents? So, why do people want to walk over broken glass? Or over fire, or sitting on nails? Why? What are you trying to prove? Does that make you peaceful? Calm? So, the point is, we like sort of weird stuff. You know, we like to sort of see people doing strange things like eating glass or whatever. And it just stimulates us, I suppose. Gives us something for our bored minds to do. But, you know, it's not really helping us at all. In Tibetan Buddhism, spiritual leaders are asked to return to the world after their death to teach and lead again. Is rebirth an option to enlightened being? Would you choose rebirth for the sake of human mental health? Oh God, no, one lifetime's enough. Do I have to come back again? I'm working really hard for you guys. Give me a break. No, you don't have an option. Your will is not controlled by you. This is an incredible thing to know, just your will, when you really understand it. How much you're conditioned. You know, you underestimate how much other people and other situations control you. You've got hardly any, actually you've got no control at all. So basically you've got no choice in the matter. Once you're enlightened, you're out of here. And you can't change that. You've got no power. Hee hee hee. Same as you, you've got no choice, and I'd like to get enlightened. Sorry, it's too late for you guys. Sooner or later, you put it off for a while. This guy came up to me once and said, you know, he listened to, I think, Ajahn Jocko years ago, and he came back after many years and he said, "I've tried to stay away from this place. But once you've heard his teachings, you just can't forget them." Put them off for a while, but eventually you just have to come and do it. You mentioned that the Buddha stated there are only four types of meditation. First, second, third, fourth jhana. Are these not stages, levels, or a distinction rather than the method vehicle of meditation in which to get there? If so, could you be more clear with what the Buddha meant by the four types of meditation? I, anapana, observing sensations, etc. Is anapana the most useful, powerful, or universal? Now, this is actually exactly what he said. It's in the Gopika Moggallana Sutta. Now, when asked, what meditation did the Buddha recommend? Because the Buddha passed away and people were arguing and they wanted to go to the expert Ananda, who was with him for such a long time, and say, "Now, in all these lifetimes, you know, did he recommend Vipassana meditation or Metta meditation?" And the answer was just the four jhanas. So that's the only meditation the Buddha recommended. How you get into those jhanas is so many different ways, but it's actually getting there. That was what the Buddha recommended. And if you actually... It's great nowadays, you know, you can get these suttas online, you can read them for yourselves,
And you see, if you read these suttas, page after page after page, first, second, third, fourth, jhana, 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 jhana. It's all over the place. That's what the Buddha recommended. And just to let you know that you're living in a good age, because for a long time, monks and nuns would not teach jhana to lay people. Even, I was told this in Vietnam, some years ago, 30 years ago or something, all the senior monks met together and they said, no, we're not going to teach jhanas to lay people, only to monks and nuns. And they made that decision. I thought, no, you're not going to attain it, it's impossible, you know, you've got too many attachments and stuff, and it's going to just make life too difficult for us. They decided that. And that's also one of the reasons why, you know, Mahasi Sayadaw, the original one, would teach the Vipassana method instead of the jhanas. Because he taught it to lay people, thinking that, you know, you can't do jhana, so we'll give you Vipassana instead. And people thought that, you know, that was good enough by itself. But all the monks know that jhanas is necessary. And there'd be monks like me and others who said, no, that's not fair. In the time of the Buddha, many lay people got jhanas, so why can't we teach jhanas to lay people? And I remember going to a monastery, I won't say which country it is, but it's, you know, quite well known, with lots of Western monks. Now you know what I'm saying. I'm not going to get that out of me. And as I was going into the reception area, one of the monks was coming out. And he grabbed me by the shoulder and pulled me aside. And he looked around, and there's no one there. He said, Ajahn Bhav, thank you for teaching jhanas. And then he ran away. It was like I was teaching him pornography or something. But that is actually a lot of time that, you know, people taught these jhanas they shouldn't be taught. And then you start teaching them, and people get them. Just like in the time of the Buddha. I don't know what the Vietnamese are good now. They teach jhanas like everybody else. And why not? You know, give you the full deal instead of just teaching just, you know, half of Buddhism. And also, you know, people wouldn't have let you read the sutras. You know, they just listen to the monks. This is what the monks say. But you wouldn't be able to look at the books yourself and find out actually what the Buddha really said. So, you know, listen to monks. Oh, Ajahn Bhav says this, Ajahn Chah says this, Ajahn Mahabhua, Venerable this. But what did the Buddha say? So now actually you can get access to that. And people are doing that. And they go to sutta classes and it's mind-blowing. You can actually see what the Buddha said. And see jhanas. Why not? So that's why it's good. What is the difference between ineffable and fatalism? Niyati Vedana. Thank you. Okay, now, the difference is, someone has been listening to me because, you know, sometimes people say about, you know, like Nibbana, or, you know, the nature of existence, and they use these words, or they call it actually the nature of God. God is ineffable. Have you heard that word before? Ineffable. It means, you know, you can't comprehend it. Words can't describe it. Your perception can't embrace it. It's just too huge. It's unknowable. Beyond conception, it is ineffable. That's what ineffable means. And I thought that was Gomaya. It means people didn't understand what it was. And I said that because there's a famous quote from Werner Heisenberg. He was one of the founders of quantum physics. And people think quantum physics is really complicated. One of the most difficult parts of science to understand. And this, of Werner Heisenberg, he has this incredible quote, if you know what quantum physics is, if you really understand it, then you will be able to explain it to the girl serving you a pint of beer in the pub. He said, that's the standard of your understanding. You can explain it to others. And that's the same with anything which is very deep and profound. You should be able to explain it, and they can understand it, even if they're not even a Buddhist. They should be able to explain Nibbana to them. So all this thing they put, it's ineffable, beyond the words, the unconditioned, beyond everything, the ground of all being. What the heck is the ground of all being? I know ground, I know being, but beings don't have grounds. Ground is soil and dirt and concrete. So a lot of these words just, you know, make no sense, but they sound profound. So please don't confuse what you don't understand as being profound. So when it comes to ineffable, I didn't like that word, ineffable. So I changed it to ineffable. And that's great. The past is ineffable. What do I mean by that? I mean, you think, if I hadn't married that guy, if, you know, I had been there just, you know, when the accident happened, if I'd have got up earlier this morning, I might have got enlightened today. We go around saying if to the past, but the past is ineffable. If you'd have got up early in this morning, you know, you may have just had an accident and just had a heart attack. You wouldn't get enlightened at all. If you hadn't married that guy, you married someone much worse. So you don't know what would have happened. But we keep on saying, oh, if I only hadn't have done that. And we waste a lot of time ifing the past. And the future is also ineffable. If I really put some, if I follow Atom Brahm's instructions, I get enlightened. If I get up really early tomorrow morning and don't wait for the Ajahn Brahm to ring the bell, I can get the first toast instead of having to wait in the queue. We have all these ifs to the future. You can't if the future. You don't know. You get up early, you find the toaster is bung. It's not working this morning. So often in life I've done that, if, and it didn't work out. So it's being ineffable is the total opposite of fatalism. You can't if the future. You don't know what's going to happen. You can't predict it, and you can't even if the past. So the past and the future is ineffable. Whenever you catch yourself saying, if I can only win the lotto, then I'll be happy. You can't if the future. You can't if the past. It's all ineffable. I like making new words. They're really good fun. If present moment time is, got another if. If present moment time is T, then thoughts happen in TAT time. How do we perceive, sense, feel, or know what is present moment? Okay, I think what they mean is the present moment, when we experience it, in a sense, it's already happened. Well, that's as present as we can get. Now, by the time we see the moon, and it's always how many seconds the light has travelled, when you see the sun, it's 8 minutes or something. Forget exactly now. We only see the old sun. We look at the stars at night. We're looking at hundreds of years into the past, thousands of years. You see that star. It's taken all that time for light to get there. So don't ever complain about someone being late. You know, the starlight is pretty late, thousands of years, and it's only just arrived. Gee. So in a sense, yes, but really you're experiencing it now. It's the experience. It's always in the present. Yeah, you know, the cause of seeing that star happened thousands of years ago, but you're seeing it now. This is present. So that is the presence. Can you tell the football joke about the four mothers discussing their sons? Do you want another joke? That's an old joke. I think when did I last tell that? Okay, this is a religious joke, sort of. Oh, it's not that late. Not that late to go. Actually, quite a few to go. Who cares? This is all about pride. So, there were four Catholic women having coffee, you know, in a nice suburb coffee shop. And one of the women said, I am so proud today of my son. Today, my son became a Catholic priest. Now all the women call him father and they bow in front of him. I'm so proud of my son. And the next mother said, oh, that's nothing. Come on. My son has been a priest for years. He is now a bishop. When he comes into the room, the people get down on one knee and they kiss his ring and they call him Your Grace. I'm so proud of my son. All the women, one knee, and they call him the Grace. And the next one says, nothing. My son was a bishop a long time ago. Now he is a cardinal. When he comes into the room, all the women get down on both knees. And they bow their head and they call him, Your Eminence, Your Eminence. I'm so proud of him. And then they all look at the fourth lady. And she pauses until she's finished her coffee and all waiting to see what she's going to say. And when she finishes her coffee, she said, that's nothing. My son never joined the church. He plays football for the West Coast Eagles. He is 6'4", blonde, blue-eyed, filthy rich. When he comes into the room, all the girls, they fall on the floor and they call him, my God, my God, my God. That's a bit sexist, but you asked for it. And the West Coast Eagles is a football team, okay? So that's what people worship. Yeah. Does breath meditation help to maintain present moment awareness and mindfulness? Yes, please clarify breath, because I'm rather confused with everything. Just let confusion be. Stop trying to get rid of confusion. What's wrong with confusion? Just embrace your confusion. And then, when you're embracing, stop trying to get rid of it. It's not confusing anymore. You know, what is the breath? How old are you? How long have you been breathing? So that you know what the breath is. The breath is what goes up your nose. Meditating is being aware of it. That's all it is. So be aware of this thing we call the breath. And that's called breath meditation. Keep it simple. Might be a weird question, no different than the others. Do you think smoking weed could help you access better or something meditation on because it relaxes body and mind? And is it bad karma if you do smoke it? Well, it depends what weed it is. If it's many of the weeds growing in the garden over here, we want to get rid of them, so if you can, please take that weed and burn it in the fire and smoke it, then that's wonderful. But if you mean smoking those illegal substances, that makes you crazy. If you've got some sort of disease or something, I'm really, you know, for medical marijuana, that's fine. Yeah, because it's, you know, helping take away pain in the body and relax you. It has medical benefits, that's fine. But a lot of times it just, you know, you literally do blow your mind and you've got none left to meditate on. And sometimes you can go very crazy with that sort of stuff. And unfortunately, when I was young, I was very lucky because, you know, that marijuana was around big time in the 60s in London. But the only thing which stopped me taking that was my best friend. He got caught smoking that at school. And he said that, you know, when he went home, his parents were just so upset. My home life is terrible because, you know, my parents found out I was caught smoking marijuana. And at that time, my father was very ill. And I really thought about that. If I take marijuana and I get caught, which is really possible, then that would literally kill my father. And I just couldn't do that to my dad. So his illness actually stopped me when I was vulnerable, you know, smoking marijuana. And later, after he died, I went to university, and that's when I got into Buddhism. And the teacher said, no, if you want to meditate, don't take any drugs. I was so happy I never did that, because many of my friends did. And the result of that, you know, there's one, not one of them, but many, but the one I focus on, Adam, you know, he went to Cambridge with me, med school, you know, brilliant guy. And from marijuana, heroin. And he became a heroin addict. It was such a sad thing. Now, you visit all my friends, he would have visited me, but I was over in Thailand, and he would steal from them. He had to, he couldn't have no choice, because of his addiction. And I saw him, you know, old friend, about 10 years ago, and he could have been this incredible specialist helping people, you know, in medicine. But he was actually, he had a job just weeding people's garden. No, not weeding, mowing people's lawns in gardening. That's all he could do. And I thought, that's such a waste of a life. And so, you know, people say, you know, gateway drugs, you know. People say, no, I'm just stopping the marijuana. He never did. I know a few others who never did either. So, you know, personally, this is personal anecdotes. You know, you don't need it. You don't need sort of marijuana to relax yourself. You can do that so easily with meditation. And you get much happier, much higher. The same with, you know, alcohol. You don't need alcohol to have a good time. You know, I never take alcohol for years and I have a wonderful time. You know, I'm a happy monk. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Some people think you're drunk. You know, I remember just doing this little ceremony over in England at a prison. They got this, they managed to talk the prison, it was an open prison, okay, to have a Buddha statue inside the prison to give a bit of peace to the prisoners. Because, you know, even in people's gardens they have prison, they have Buddha statues. You know, it's a symbol of peace, and it calms people down. You may not know this, but Winston Churchill had a Buddha statue by his bedside throughout the Second World War. He was a Christian, but he had that Buddha behind his, by his bedside because it reassured him and gave him some confidence in some of the darkest days. You know, he suffered from depression. You know, in a war, he's responsible for this nation, and he came really close, you know, to being annihilated. So, you know, the Buddha statue is a symbol of something very, 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 very beautiful. And so that, where's I going with this? I remember we installed this Buddha statue at this prison. And I was so inspired. We did a little ceremony of walking around three times. We had some incense and candles. And of course, there's always these a few prisoners, you know, we're just looking on what the hell's going on. There's going to be a big feast of Thai people to come along and brought exquisite Thai food for everyone. They were just hanging out for the ceremony to finish so they could gorge themselves on the food. And I caught them in the corner of my eye. They looked at me. I had this huge smile on my face. And I caught them saying, that monk's on the gear. And they were convinced of that because they'd never seen someone smile that much except through drugs. And you don't need to have the drugs to smile. So it's unnecessary. As a Buddhist, what is one's responsibility or loyalty to one's family? I regard my family as a rather toxic and unhealthy group. Is a Buddhist response to send loving kindness and happy thoughts, yet to visit them, say, once a week or once a month? Can you give some insights into the correct way of treating family of the unsupportive kind? Loving kindness goes two ways. Goes to your family, also goes to you as well. So people sacrifice themselves and they don't look about themselves. They think, oh, I've got to look after my family, I've got to look after this, I've got to look after that, even though it's hurting them terribly. So it's a balance, your loving kindness to your family and also to yourself. Equal. So, you know, if it's going to harm you, then don't go. Once a month, once a lifetime. If it's going to harm you, don't go. It's not going to help you. It's not going to help them either. If you can handle it and it's good for them, it's good for you, then go. So your family, you know, it's one of those things, you don't choose your family, you can choose your friends. You're stuck with your family. But, you know, try your best to look after them and help them whatever way you can, because especially parents, you know, they have looked after you, many of them, so, you know, look after them. But, you know, if they've hurt you and harmed you, sometimes it may be they've gone through stuff in their life. So, but if you, you know, visiting them makes you really upset and is not good for you, then, as they say in the Chinese tradition, to love the tiger, but at a distance. You don't go up to the tiger and pat it on the head. You get your hand bitten off. Some families are like that. So you can love your family at a distance. And send them a Christmas card, but don't visit. If someone is fixating you with the eyes, with an angry or neutral face, what would you do? If they're giving you the evil eye. then you get a mirror, so they can, the evil eye goes back to them. What if you smile and that person doesn't react? Then that's their business. Our job is just to smile at the person. And what they do is their business. We've done our duty, and that's all we can do. So some people are angry, and sometimes they're going through stuff. So you know, sometimes you've got to give them space sometimes. So don't try and change people. That's one of the reasons why that book, Good, Bad, Who Knows, in the United States is called Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. And the reason it's called that is because here some years ago, and a few people know who I'm talking about, there was a young lady on this retreat, I won't say her name, but it begins with R. She knows she is still back. And she was really fed up with me, telling everyone to be happy and sadhu, sadhu, sadhu nonsense, really getting up her nose. And just people laughing and smiling everywhere, because she felt really bad, she felt grumpy. And so she said, I'm just really fed up on this retreat, I feel miserable, I feel grumpy, and you make me feel guilty about, you know, being grumpy, because everyone's supposed to be happy, and we're supposed to be smiling, we're supposed to be blissing out, and I don't feel like anything like that. I'm really fed up. So what I did, I said, okay, wait here for a moment. I went in the office, and I printed her out a grumpy license. I already mentioned the happiness license. So it was another on letterhead paper, and this license grants to this lady, beginning with R, who was in the youth group, comes from Indonesia, but I won't mention her name. She doesn't mind. And this license grants her permission to be grumpy for any reason or no reason at all for the rest of her life. Sign that, jump up. There you go, you can be grumpy now. Don't feel guilty about being grumpy. You've got a license, you've got permission signed by me to be grumpy. You know what happened? She loved that grumpy license so much, she wasn't grumpy anymore. She was happy, she laughed. So that's the trouble sometimes. Don't try and change yourself, just be. And then you're happy. If you feel grumpy, just be grumpy, for goodness sake. So when a person's angry, you know, they'd be angry. Just give them a space to be angry. If you really want, I'll get you an angry license. I won't give you a psychotic license, because that's going too far. Can I design my own mantra? Yes. How do I choose the words I say? Oh, just whatever comes up. How many words do I need? However many you want. Why do the gaps between the words block the thoughts or emotions? It's actually the words block the thoughts or emotions, and the gaps start to open up space and silence. So it introduces silence between the thoughts. Can you explain the theory behind the mantras? Yeah, I just did. Please tell us how to handle control freaks. Run. My boss asked me once, twice per week about my progress for the goal set for the end of the year. This drives me crazy. I don't know how to behave. I can control myself. Do not need an external controller. Well, you just tell him. It's just, it's coming. Tell him the check's in the mail. Yeah, the progress is good. So, you know, you can always just, you know, you're not lying, but you're not telling him the truth either. Just tell him what he wants to know in a way which means you don't lie. And so you can, you know, use this, the same speech which, you know, people like Tony Abbott use. Well, according to the outcomes and the prognostication of the future survey of the outcomes, I can say that at the end of the day, the progress is as good as you could possibly expect under the circumstances in the present economic climate. Whatever that means. You know, you learn how to say, you know, go my yang, you know, bullshit. And that's all they want to hear. But, you know, if you just say, you know, shut up, or I'm not telling you, or whatever, then they obviously get angry. So, you know, learn the jargon, learn how it works in office. Now, I know that, and I'm a monk. I'm a boss. If someone is observing five precepts, how can they get rid of insects, ants in their house? Oh, without killing them. You just don't get them in there to begin with. Keep it clean. So, you know, put in the termite protection before you buy the house. No, or build a house. When people buy houses, they've got to have a termite inspection, first of all, when you build one, you can actually keep them out so they don't ever come in there. And if there's ants in there, it's only because you're not keeping it clean. Now, the ants only go there for the food. They're not coming in there to say hello and just to be hospitable. Is it okay to eat food, cake, etc., which has used alcohol as an ingredient, or have medicine which contains alcohol? If the answer is yes, why is it not okay to have a glass of wine occasionally? Any excuse to get some alcohol. No, it's, if food, cake has alcohol in it, it's baked, and so the alcohol is all gone. So it's not alcoholic. And medicine which contains alcohol, it'll only be a tiny amount. You don't get drunk on eating, drinking alcoholic medicine or something. But then, glass of wine. And people think it has medicinal value. And that was actually, it's an interesting case study. For many years, I did this research in California, and they found out that people who take wine had better cardiac health than those who didn't take wine. And that for years, was people saying, if you get heart disease, drink some wine, drink some alcohol. And then someone had a look at that research and examined it again. And then they actually divided it into the doing research in California into the different economic levels of people. Because they found that the people who drank wine, compared to, say, the people who drank beer, they had the higher incomes. And the people who didn't drink wine had the lower incomes. And they found it was the income level, not the wine, which actually was the cause of good cardiac health or low cardiac health. So when they got people on the same income bracket, those who drank wine and those who didn't, the wine was actually bad for the health. Had worse cardiac outcomes. So sometimes you've got to be careful. You have a correlation. Wine drinking, good cardiac health, there's a correlation here, but the cause is not the wine. The cause is people who drink wine have got better economic, they're in a high economic bracket, and that's all. It was the same as the tobacco industry, who did research which proved people who smoke cigarettes are less likely to get Alzheimer's disease. The correlation was obvious until someone pointed out the reason is not the tobacco. The reason is that people who smoke don't live long enough to get Alzheimer's. That was the cause. So you've got to be careful with some of these statistics which come out. After a beautiful walking meditation, when I came back to main hall, the floor looked curved to me, just like file of bamboos. So I have to walk more carefully or I feel that surface. What is happening? Yeah, brilliant. Now when you're doing some beautiful walking meditation, you're getting some happiness and joy. Your mindfulness is increasing. And you're starting to see things in a beautiful different way. That's brilliant stuff. Because this is actually what happens when the mind gets a lot of power. You can see things not in the same old perception. Other perceptions which you usually deny are now open to you. So you're doing really well. Nimittas are just right next door when you get things like that happening. So you're freeing your perceptions. You see the bamboo before. You had a beautiful meditation. You come and hear the bamboo is beautiful. And it appears different than you've seen before. Great stuff. Ajahn Brahm, even after 4 days, I'm still struggling to sleep, struggling to wake up, struggling to stop worrying, struggling to meditate, etc. What should I do? Enjoy your struggle. Stop trying to get rid of struggling. Accept and embrace the struggle. And then you don't struggle with struggling. If you don't struggle with struggling, the energy of struggling disappears. When you fight it, I don't want this, that causes more struggle. It's not where your experience is the problem, it's your reaction to experience. That's the problem. So when you're trying to sleep, stop trying to sleep. Your bed is the most comfortable place in this whole retreat. Soft, warm, beautiful, and you can just lie back there. And this is, it was a time a couple of years ago, I don't know why, I was finding it hard to sleep. And then I found out the reason was I was trying too hard to sleep. So instead I said, I'm not going to go to sleep tonight. My bed is so comfortable. It's the one place in this whole monastery where people don't ask me questions. I can lay back here and I can just relax quietly. And it's beautiful physical feel. I can stretch. You know, my no aches and pains in the knees or anywhere. Oh, this is so cozy in my bed. And when I didn't want to go to sleep, the next thing in the morning I woke up. I mean, I was trying to go to sleep. It was giving me the stress that I couldn't go to sleep. So, don't try to go to sleep. Just enjoy being in the bed. Don't try to meditate. Just sit here and just be. And then you have the reaction. No worrying. If you are worrying, just allow it to be open the door of your heart to the worry. Remember that story I said about the angry eating monster? Get out of here, you don't belong. It just gets bigger. That's what's happening there. What do you like to eat most for dana? Breakfast. This is a secret. And what's... So I'm not going to tell you. Most people know anyway. Actually, they think they know, but they don't know. And I'm not going to tell you. Because this is actually a beautiful thing which a monk said a long time ago. He said, I like eating pure food. He said, pure food, it means, you know, organic, you know, washed, no, what is it? No. Food which comes from a pure heart. I thought, what a great answer. So I like eating things which come from a pure heart. Isn't that nice? At what, there's also a few other things I like to eat. But that's the main one. At what stage should one seeing or hearing stop? Wouldn't it be better to meditate with open eyes so one can recognize when seeing stops immediately? You don't recognize when it stops. You recognize it has stopped. Can you ever recognize the moment you fall asleep? You can't do that. You know, I was trying for years trying to do that, but you know, I couldn't catch it because then I was, next thing I knew I woke up. Missed it again. Even the time when you close your eyes, I can see the inside of my eyelids. The moment it stops, I don't know, but I knew a few seconds later it had stopped. Sight has stopped. So that's why it's good to actually to close your eyes. I sometimes wonder, as developing one's mind seems most important thing to do, and time is short, that I should ordain. It's hard to have time conditions and access to teachers in lay life. I don't want to do something I regret, either by ordaining or not ordaining, and being unsure makes it harder for me in lay life too, as I shy away from major long-term commitments. How does one know if and when to ordain, especially I'm nowhere near the jhanas, blah, blah, blah. So just remember the great wisdom of one of the greatest ajahns, Ajahn Nike. Just do it. So don't think about it, just do it. Whatever it is. The body seems to be like a prison for the mind. Blocking it by all the sensual inputs from getting free. When a body dies, also the senses die and the mind gets free. Why is the mind searching for new prisons after the previous prison died? The mind should know that it will be imprisoned again, yes. But that's just like the person who actually does walk out of prison. They get released. How many prisoners re-offend? They go back to jail again. Because they are not used to freedom. In fact, many prisoners are afraid of being released. Especially if you've been in the jail a long time. That's why 30, 40 years, some people have been in prison. And they'd rather stay in the prison because that's their comfort zone. They got used to it. Freedom scares them. That's one of the reasons why you get scared when you start to be free. It's natural, so don't think bad about yourself, but it's what happens. The body starts to vanish. Ah! I don't want it to vanish. It hurts, but yeah, but at least I know it. And it's scary sometimes, freedom. Even you may have a big problem like grief or just, you know, anxiety. At least you know that anxiety. You know that grief. You got used to it. When someone takes it away, scary. You're in a prison, and the doors are open, but you can't walk out. So this is one of the biggest problems in meditation, giving people the confidence to go out of that fear and to taste freedom. Unfortunately, the different stages of meditation, you taste deeper and deeper freedoms at each stage. You don't have to have it all in one go. That would just blow your head off and you'd just be too scared. You run back inside again. You can't take too much freedom all at once. But little by little, you get more and more free. Fear of your past and future. Why can't people just let go of their past? Because they're used to it. It's their prison. And when I ask them to walk out, no, I'm not ready yet. I'd rather stay in jail. Because that's what you're used to. Fear of anxiety for the future. It's hard. You've got to nudge a person. Hold their hand. Come on. Have a look what it's like outside. I'm there. You're safe. And the more time they spend outside of jail. So this is actually your 9-day parole period from jail. After this retreat, you go back again. Yeah, taste what it's like. And afterwards, you can go out again. And go out again until you get used to it. And all the different prisons, you can walk out any time you want. That's the most incredible thing. All the stuff of the past, the trauma of the past, the fear of the future, your bodily aches and pains, you can walk out any time you want. But it's hard, because we don't have the courage. My job is to give you that encouragement. Hey, come on, get outside, it's nice out here. Oh, but I like my business though. I spent so much time decorating my prison cell. I got this nice husband in the prison cell with me. Got these nice little prisoner kids. And you know, my prison cell is really big. I just bought it from another prisoner. 4 bedrooms, rumpus room, and I got this nice little car in prison, a nice run around. I don't want to leave. But this is actually, look about it for you. Yeah. You have this taste of freedoms, and that just really encourages you, and you get more and more time out until you can let go of all the grief, the past, the fear, the anger, and get out. But it's so nice to be out. It's a bit weird at first when you get let go of all your anger. It's weird. But after a while you get used to it and you like it, and you can walk out, and you don't need to go into that prison of anger ever again. That's liberation. So, there we go. Those are all the questions. I'm now liberated. I'm free of the prison. So, thank you all for listening again tonight. I hope it was useful. If it wasn't, well, try my best. Sadhu. 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 Okay, have a nice night. And please, don't try to go to sleep. Just lay down and just... Those who can't go to sleep, try to stay awake.